Good morning, Sandy Williams sitting in for Earl Ingram, the Earl Ingram Show, Wednesday morning. Kelvin, what's the call-in number?
The number is 844-967-2789.
We've been talking this morning for this 9 to 10 hours segment on to John Hopkins. John knows a lot about the healthcare industry, provides a particular service to the healthcare industry in terms of IT support for a business model that I find particularly attractive that involves patients paying directly for their healthcare, cash payments essentially, directly to the healthcare providers who are willing to receive payment directly, might not work directly for hospitals, are independent, and the patient would, however, have insurance for catastrophic level coverage, so they wouldn't be exposed to any more. They wouldn't be exposed to any more dollar out of pocket costs than they would be if they were carrying insurance as they normally do today and paying their deductible. But they would be exposed potentially to far less on an annual basis, year to year, and they would have coverage that would protect them against the catastrophic. John, is that an accurate summary?
That is. That's the free market, what we would consider to be the free market healthcare system. And this is a movement that's becoming more interesting all the time, which is people are starting to view this as a true free market opportunity as opposed to one that is controlled by the insurance industry.
And however, there would be a layer of insurance at the top, but the insurance industry would only come into play when you're actually hospitalized or experiencing extreme costs.
Right.
Is that right?
Extreme costs. And this is the same thing happens with your car. And it's important to go back to those because in both your car and your house, you're incented to keep bad things from happening to you. And rather than using your insurance as a cash management tool, which is how we basically use healthcare insurance, it's a way of managing cash in the environment, not just for handling exceptional situations. You don't do that with any other insurance. You don't use it that way in your house insurance or your car insurance. You don't file a claim every time you change your oil.
Yeah. We have a couple of more callers on the line. We've got Michael Cummey on the line. Michael, what say you? No, Michael's not on the line. How about Kurt? Do we have Kurt on the line?
Yeah, there's actually a direct primary care operation that's been going on for at least 2 years in Madison. The primary doctor that started all this, her name is Nicole Hempkes, and I would encourage you folks to get her to basically come into another interview with this and really tell the folks in Milwaukee what's really going on, because that business in Madison is exploding. She continues to hire.
You don't have a question or comment on there.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry.
Did you finish? I'm sorry.
Well, I think you guys need to get Nicole Hempkes in because, according to one of the folks here in Milwaukee, there's some kind of a system that goes on that's basically preventing this from happening in Milwaukee. So let Nicole tell you what's happening in Madison, and it will really help the folks out in Milwaukee.
Yeah. John, I mean, I don't know what Kurt is getting at in terms of something that's an impediment in Milwaukee. I'm not sure how there could be an impediment other than the fact that the hospital systems in Milwaukee are quite powerful between Frederick and the Aurora system. But this would strike me as being something that is going to be available to the extent that practitioners decide to make it available, right?
There's a couple of things happening in Milwaukee that are in this area. One is that the major hospital systems have merged and they are aligned with a particular insurance carrier. And so if you're Aurora, you primarily, you'll have Anthem Blue Cross. If you are Prism, then you're at Aurora. If you're at, ProHealth, then you're at Aurora, et cetera. And this limits the physicians, which you can see.
Yeah.
So if you want to see physicians at all three, you have to buy the gold health plan at $2,650 a month to have that privilege of being able to choose your doctor.
That's under the existing traditional health insurance profile. Mm-hmm. But if you pursued your health profile, in which you would only have excess coverage insurance, you'd be seeing the provider of your choice when you're spending out of your own pocket, correct?
That's correct. It's similar to the way you repair your car. You go to the place that you want and file claim. Now, you may be reimbursed at different rates depending on that, but that's a different situation. I think what Kurt was referring to is also that very often if you go to a hospital in the Milwaukee area and say, I want to pay cash, they'll say, no, you can't, which is not true, but they tell you that and you walk away going, oh, I have to pay. Or they say, yes, you can pay cash, but you have to pay the negotiated rate by the insurance company, so there's really no advantage to doing so.
Yeah.
The other problem is that many of the carriers explicitly prohibit you from publishing a cash price that's lower than the price that they reimburse at. And that means that you have no competitive advantage. Now, if you call their office directly and sort of wink, wink, nod, nod, talk out of the side of your mouth, you can, instead of being charged $2,700 for a pelvic CT, it's $612. I'm using some approximate but real numbers.
Yeah.
But they can't publish that. It's sort of like those ads that, our prices are too low to publish or too low to advertise. It's that same deal. Did I get the essence of?
Absolutely. There? Thank you, John, for calling. I'm going to shift gears now to another fellow who's come in the office, but thank you so much for calling. We're going to do this. We're going to proceed with this on another show because I think healthcare is something that's touching everyone. And I think what you're proposing, and I think we'll try and get a healthcare provider on who's providing this kind of healthcare to further talk about mm-hmm. this, because I think this is something that through self-help, the people, the listeners out there can go out and find these kinds of providers, and the marketplace will develop as rapidly as there is demand for it. And I think the demand could grow quite rapidly because financially, it seems to make a great deal of sense, a lot of sense, and could save the public a lot of money, both in terms of what they spend out of their pocket and what they need to spend based on the wellness that they might otherwise achieve. So thanks, John. Thanks for calling in.
I look forward to continuing the conversation.
Yeah, thank you. So now I've got here in the studio with me Mark Ard. Mark is a friend of mine. We see each other pretty regularly at coffee. And I asked Mark to come in because I think he has an interesting background and personal story fits him into both an age group and an experience group that needs to be listened to and needs to be heard and is actually very interested in what's going on, but however feels helpless about actually affecting it, as helpless as all of us do, I think because of what I was talking about earlier, which is the fact that no matter what the people think, the government seems to do what it is that is the dance that is called by what I call K Street, which I mean lobbyists and the interests of money. Mark, tell us a little bit about yourself. You're from rural Wisconsin, right?
Yes. Good morning, and thank you for the introduction, Sandy. Yeah. Appreciate that. Born and raised central Wisconsin.
Yeah, where? Is it Neshkora? Is that
No, Nisida.
Oh, Nisida.
Nisida.
Okay.
It's a little truck stop right there.
So Nisida is a place where you ice fish in the winter.
Ice fish, hunt, and drink.
Yeah, right. And it is Wisconsin.
Like, it is Wisconsin through and through, baby.
Through and through.
Yeah, you bet.
And you went to high school there.
Yep.
And then you went in the Marines. Did you go directly in the Marines?
I graduated about a year early, younger than most of my cohorts.
Yeah.
So I waited about a year. I was just kind of twiddling my thumbs and got in a little bit of trouble. I think I'm one of the last of a dying breed of Marines that can actually say that it was either the Marine Corps or jail. So
okay, but
and I'm not going to tell you why, but that's a story for another time.
Yeah, but the Marine Corps was something that you were in fact, sort of enthusiastic about going into? I mean, you were...
Yeah, I mean, both my grandfathers were Marines. My Grandpa Hard served in Korea with the 1st Marine Division, and my Grandpa Gabe served in the Pacific in World War II with the 6th Marines, which no longer was stood down after the war. So, yeah.
And you are a Semper Fi Marine yourself.
Yeah,
you are
Semper Fi Marine.
Semper
right,
Fi Marine. Hoorah, right?
Hoorah. That's right. That's right.
And so you know, your Marine experience was important to you. On the other hand, it wasn't an experience that you'd necessarily want everyone else to have, right?
I mean, it's not for everyone. That's for sure. Looking back on it now, I'm 42 years old. I joined when I was 18.
Mm-hmm.
Did 8 years active service, 7.5 and 6 months inactive, whatever. But it was a mixed bag. I mean, it was an amazing experience.
Yeah, but the part of it that involved warfare, you were deployed and you were in war.
Well, that sucked.
Yeah, and I'm just saying it had a serious impact on you.
Oh, absolutely.
And it's something that's very hard to recover from, isn't it?
It is. I mean, especially, you know, hindsight being what it is and knowing what we know about the pretense for why we invaded Iraq in the first place and just reflecting on it generally, just not in the macro sense, but in the micro sense of the individual experience.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a mixed bag. I'm sure a lot of veterans in my cohort probably feel the same way, you know.
And so I take it from your standpoint, the people who've never gone through what you've gone through, who cheer and cheer for the notion of America arming itself to the teeth and going to war and sending young men off to war, is something that is upsetting to you, to the extent that that war might not be something that is in the real American interest.
You know, I think, like most other people, I recognize patterns, and I can't help but notice that a lot of the people I see beating the drums, you know, for war, we call them, I think, chicken hawks back mm-hmm. in the day, they never tend to make it to the recruiting office for some reason, which is really weird to me. I don't know what that's about. I mean, but I think it kind of speaks for itself.
So. Well, so, you know, one of the reasons I wanted to have you on is that we talk here and want to re-examine American foreign policy and defense policy, at least I do, and I'm concerned about it. I never
yes.
served.
Yeah.
And I think that the people who have served have a viewpoint that might be refreshing for people to understand and hear about. We're going to break right now. We'll be back shortly. Show Sandy Williams sitting in for Earl Ingram Wednesday morning. We're cruising into the last hour. Calvin, how do people call into the show?
The number is.
Oh, he's got to look at it.
I know. I have a brain fart. I had it memorized in the last couple segments. Give me 1 second. It's 844-967-2789.
There we go, Calvin. You'll get this down. You know, I say that I don't have it down. The reason I ask you to do it is I don't know. Earl, on the other hand, Earl, on the other hand, can do it in his sleep. The only problem with Earl is he can't tell you what day it is. You know, but he can tell you the phone number to call in. So today I've got Mark Ard here in the studio with me, and I introduced Mark in the prior segment. Mark is a young friend of mine. Well, I think he's young. He doesn't think he's young. He's 42. He said, but. And a Marine vet, and also someone who's very smart in my book, and has thought through a lot of issues that we that we think about, but he thinks about it from a perspective that's different than mine. We might reach agreement on things, but I think he's less subject to being questioned than I am, for instance, about my views about foreign policy and defense expenditures. Mark served in Iraq. Mark was, 6 years in the Marines?
8 years. Seven and a half active and 6 months inactive.
Yeah. Yeah. And saw was deployed into combat zones and, you know, saw things and experienced things that were life-changing, I'm sure. And so, you know, one of the things we were talking about in the first hour, Mark, was the extent to which what I called K Street, which is the, mm-hmm. the lobbying organization, the lobbyists who have their offices on K Street in Georgetown, who have so much to do with public policy.
Yep.
And, you know, they have a lot to do with banking policy and the bank failures and railroad regulation and the railroad failures and all kinds of things. But the thing that I think is most glaring and the thing that we don't talk about that's sort of our dirty little secret is the extent to which K Street rules our defense budget and yeah. indirectly as well rules our foreign policy.
Yeah.
It's so clear that Ike Eisenhower, when he gave his valedictory speech, his mm-hmm. last speech as president, and he warned us about the military-industrial complex
yep.
and told us that a peacetime military tied to a big defense budget was a formula for danger societally, that complex could become something that our economy would become so dependent upon.
Which it is.
It is now today, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you think of all the tertiary outsourcing and the multiple effects that it has across the economy, you know, when the giant corporations, Raytheons and so forth, that farm out a lot of their work to some of the more medium-sized places,
right.
and then they farm out a lot of their work to these smaller mom-and-pop joints. I mean, I have a family business, or my family has a business, like my uncle up in New Lisbon near Nacita, and, you know, they get contracts that are sourced from the Navy and other places
sure.
and everything. So,
And it isn't just that your family gets that job, because that's essentially, those dollars are in the military budget, but well, they are, because they get sourced into the thing that is then built for the military. But
yeah, yeah.
the money you spend at the drugstore, and the money that the druggist spends—I mean, there's this multiplier effect. We spend $850 billion directly into a military budget, but when you put the multiplier effect on that, how many dollars does that turn into in the economy? It's trillions of dollars.
Quite a lot, yeah.
Trillions of dollars that ultimately become dependent on the defense budget.
Absolutely.
And that defense budget, having so much to do with our economy, is not even a sleeping giant. It's a giant.
Oh, yeah.
It's right there.
It's alive and kicking, man. It's well, and it's doing quite well, and it has been doing quite well.
Right. And so you mentioned that you were you went to Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
And you ask yourself questions now about whether the risk you put your own life in and the lives that were lost of your peers and the lives that were lost amongst the Iraqis, whether that was worth the blood, and why was it that we were risking our blood and fortune in Iraq, right?
Well, there's a lot to unpackage there. With regards to Iraq and the pretense with which we justified the invasion, you know, like I mentioned earlier, you know, everyone, I think it's pretty well generally accepted by everyone that was a load of crap, you know. And I don't know how should we feel about that, you know. Of course, when you're young, I was like early 20s, sergeant, you know, and of course this was not long after 9/11. So we were very enthused about getting out there and doing what needed to be done without reliving and rehashing all of mm-hmm. that. I mean, I think you nailed on we've nailed a couple things here. The money influence, right? The disconnect between people, you know, working class and poor people who usually are the source of manpower for the military are completely disconnected from the people who make these policies and the lobbyists,
right.
which is a problem. The money problem, of course, the greasing of hands all over, I'm sure, Washington, D.C. and other places, and the economic part, which you know, translates into the political issue. Because if you're going to tell all these people out there who are relying on these dollars, mm-hmm. you know, what else are they going to do? How are we going to retool?
Well, but so in Iraq, you know, it doesn't require much of a history recollection to remember what happened. You know, we invaded Iraq.
Yeah.
And we did it under a pretense that ended up being false.
Yep.
But we invaded a country and essentially destroyed the country that was.
Mm-hmm.
We did it in the name of Hi, the Earl Ingram Show. Sandy Williams sitting in for Earl Ingram Wednesday morning, talking about a variety of issues associated with, well, I suppose it all grew out of bank failures and railroad accidents, and then that kind of led into our failed health system, all of which seems to relate to the power of money in politics and the ability for those with money and to get the government to back off of the regulation that they maybe should be doing or were doing or could do, to get the government to formulate a health system which is broken but very profitable for certain segments of the health system, to create a health system that consumes almost 20% of our GDP. It's going to eat us up, as John Hopkins, an earlier guest, described. Mark Ard is here in the studio, and we're talking now about the military-industrial complex, the extent to which it's affected his life. He was in the Marines for almost 8 years, deployed abroad, deployed in Iraq, a lawyer, a loyal Marine. I know that because I think I've made a joke about Marines at one point, and I saw the fire in his eyes, so I realized he might be a Marine who has questions about our foreign policy and about our military policies, but he has no question about the Marines.
I do have questions.
Yeah.
I do have questions. Yeah. Absolutely.
We have a caller, Catherine on the line. Catherine, what are you calling about? Catherine?
No, what's going on?
I don't know. Maybe she's up there on the screen, but maybe Calvin can't put her through.
All right.
One of the things and the reason I wanted to have you in today, Mark, is that here we are as a country talking every day about Ukraine, spending lots of money with respect to our defense budget and providing munitions and actually putting at risk the notion that we might have, you know, there are plenty of people in Congress and callers who call in on the radio say, you know, we should put boots on the ground there. We should fight next to the Ukrainians. And then we also have Taiwan sitting out there like a teapot blowing its whistle. It's boiling.
It is. Yeah.
And there again, we have the same sort of threat. And my question is, how do we formulate these foreign policies? And do you get it? I mean, as a serviceman, you went to war based on a foreign policy that was not formulated by you. And here we are, sit on the brink of putting ourselves and our treasure and blood somehow at risk associated with Taiwan and Ukraine and distant places. What do you think about all that?
Well, I'd like to know what we get out of it. Like, I can't think of anything that we actually got out of our adventures in Iraq or Afghanistan, which was a complete debacle as it, you know, the way it ended and everything. No matter, I think everyone would agree with that. And I don't.
Well, it was a debacle while it was ongoing.
No, it was a debacle while it was going. It was a debacle. I mean, no, it was
a debacle. Well, once you get into a debacle,
well, no one has
getting your hand out of a hornet's nest.
No one has explained to me, to my satisfaction, why my friends are dead,
mm-hmm.
you know, and what we got out of it. You know what I mean? And I don't see what we're going to get out of going, of putting troops on the ground, work side by side with the Ukrainians. God bless them. I mean, I feel terrible for their situation, but I don't see where that is in our interest. You know, maybe in the interest of some military industrial folks and shareholders and everything, because that's a lot of money that we seem to just never be able to, you know, if, you know, there's really no discussion.
Well, you know, there is a discussion of some, you know, I know that I'll talk to young people in the military and people who are cheering for the military but have never been in it, who talk about the United States defending democracy wherever it is, and it's our job to make sure that democracy withstands assault on it wherever it happens. And so it sounds like, and we tend to attack countries that we don't describe to ourselves as being democratic. So it sounds like we spend a good deal of our mind and attention on deciding whether other countries are ruling themselves in a manner that we find acceptable.
I think most of the people around the world sees right through that rhetoric. But a lot of Americans here at home don't. They tend to look at it through rose-colored glasses, you know. But I think most people around the world are done with that kind of rhetoric coming from the United States, because we have such an abysmal record of intervening and propping up people who are the most undemocratic you can imagine for our own ends, and not for the general public. It's certainly not for, you know, people working here in Wisconsin or throughout the most of the country. It's for the manufacturers, the big businesses, and the lobbyists and everything. It's in their interest, because that's a cash cow. And you can't, man, you can't let that thing go away. That's a gravy train, baby. That's, you know, there's no money in peace.
Yeah.
Well, you know what I mean? There's no money in peace. And that has an effect. And to suggest that it doesn't is ludicrous. It's ludicrous.
Well, let's take Ukraine, for example. The United States since about 2010 has taken a very inordinate level of interest in Ukraine. It's a country that was part of the USSR. It's a very young country in terms of it being an established independent country. It didn't get its start until 1991. It was right up through 2019 viewed as about the most corrupt country. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the famous Trump phone call with Zelensky, a part of it involved a discussion of how Ukraine was going to clean up its corruption so that we could send it more money.
Yeah.
There's been a sort of an inordinate American interest in Ukrainian politics. There's a whole sector of people in Washington who were in favor of the Ukrainian government that was pro-Russian before the 2014 revolution. There's a whole group of people in Washington who were very pro-separatist nationalist. Mm-hmm. And there were people making money in Ukraine like mad. And half of our political scandals over the past 3 years have involved channels of money from Ukraine flowing to Paul Manafort, flowing to Hunter Biden.
Yep.
You know, you pick the political scandal and you can find Ukrainian hands in it. And so what troubles me is the inability of America to stand back and examine itself and make a lessons learned. You suffered Iraq.
Yeah. A lot of people suffered Iraq.
And how much have we done in the way of a lessons learned analysis?
Oh, I don't think we've, no. I think that our attitude that America, you know, it's like the, almost, it's like Manifest Destiny, you know, that America is I guess what I'm trying to say is I don't see much of a difference in between when contrasting the neoconservative view of American hegemony and the neoliberal view of American hegemony, right? And the arrogance tied into that. And, you know, I think that we're shooting ourselves in our own foot, you know, because we have this kind of conceit that we can go around the world, shake our fingers at everyone and say that you should be democratic, while with the other hand, we're undermining all of these nations with the things that we're doing. And, you know, it's, you know, I've traveled overseas, both in the military and out of the military, and I like to talk to people around the world to see how they're the perception of the United States and how they feel about it. And, you know, on one hand, they say, you know, we love the American people. But on the other hand, your policies and your attitude and the way that you go about your business is really turning us off.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that we need to think about that. I think that our reputation and our prestige around the world has completely bottomed out, you know, and that's going to have an effect. I mean, we've proven ourselves to be unreliable for one. Adventurous for another. And I think people around the world are just getting sick of it and they're looking for other ways to go.
Well, my sense is that China, for instance,
that's a perfect example.
Xi recently announced publicly that their policy was going to be one of non-intervention into the internal affairs of other countries, and what they were going to be interested in was the external affairs of other countries, the activities of countries that affected other countries. Mm-hmm. And that's what makes sense. That's what people have an interest in internationally, is what are you doing that has an effect on the world at large?
Yep.
And you know, so I think China's in a position now to try and play a peacemaker. They've already started in the Middle East.
Yeah, geopolitically, the perception, the view, the optics of China being the peace broker, you know, right? Which is what they, I mean, we've left this lane wide open for them, you know, and they're taking advantage of it wholeheartedly, not just between Ukraine and Russia, but also what they just accomplished between Saudi Arabia and Iran.
Right.
Which, of course, is, I'm sure Israel doesn't care for that at all. And, you know, with the Israel lobby, right, going back to the lobbyist influence is huge. And, of course, you can't talk about it without immediately being smeared, you know, as an anti-Semite or, you know what I'm saying? Just like you can't talk about a nuanced, balanced discussion about the Ukraine and Russia conflict without being labeled a Putin puppet or whatever. I mean, it's just, it's ridiculous.
Well, I mean, my concern and the whole show is actually centered around the influence of money. But one of the things I said is that whenever something is bipartisan,
that's how you
look out.
That's right.
Look out.
Because that reminds me of an old George Carlin thing. I can't use his colorful language, but he used to say in some of his skits, whenever there's a bipartisan thing, that's an extra, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Coming down the pike. So be careful.
Be careful, because when everyone agrees on it, like the neoliberals and neocons.
Oh yeah. Okay. There's certain things policy, that are always consistent on that.
When things line up.
Mm-hmm.
That means that right. That means that the money, you know, the lobbyists all agree. What I've said is, if it's if it's bipartisan, either the lobbyists don't care at all, or you know, like
or
like,
they've rubber stamped it,
or they care a lot.
Yeah,
and it's right in agreement with what they want.
Oh, absolutely.
Because that's the way Washington has come to work, and you know, the cynicism we have about Washington's behavior is going to be a problem in the long run, our country.
Domestically, it's a debacle. Well,
don't you think that created Donald Trump?
Absolutely. And this is the thing that drives me absolute bonkers when talking to other, you know, left-leaning so-called progressive or liberal types who can't seem to figure it out or make the connection, probably because of the Russiagate thing that was, you know, dumped on us for the last few years through the media, but not that's a tangent. Yes, of course. I mean, how do you think it looks domestically, politically speaking, when you've got Joe Biden over in Ukraine hobnobbing with Zelensky at the same time in Palestine, Ohio, that train derailment, and that is just absolute atrocity that's happening to those people there. And this is just a drop in the bucket. I mean, we could unravel and unpackage this all day.
Well, I mean,
but the perception
that perception, but also just the perception of behavior in the world and the impacts on the world, and the coincidence of moneyed interest with behavior, it strikes me. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, Donald Trump.
Well, Trump went to
from Trump country, don't you?
Oh, absolutely, man.
And I bet you have blood relatives who believe in him.
Absolutely.
And my view of Donald Trump is that he represented a public persona of someone who was cynical of the establishment.
Yes.
And people are so cynical about the establishment. Mm-hmm. And what they view as the establishment is what I'm talking about now, which is the power of money in politics. Politics has become an amorphous, untouchable establishment, something where things happen and we don't have much to do with it. Mm-hmm. For many people, that's what the establishment means. For me, you know, I went to law school, was a lawyer for life. I am the establishment, okay? but for people who don't picture themselves as being the establishment, when they describe the establishment, they're talking about them.
Yeah.
They're talking about the people who are ruining their lives and they can't do anything about it.
Yeah, I think they're, in terms of like an archetype, you would be like the East Coast, Ivy League, intelligentsia types.
Gosh.
Yeah. Sorry.
You pointing a finger?
No. Yeah. But I mean, generally, I think that because there's a real disconnect, you know, and it's not just on the left. I think it's also on the right. And I think that there's a populist, you know, bent that's going on right now that the establishment is just not recognizing. But I mean, they're leaving the lane wide open.
So what do we? We're going to go to a break shortly. We're coming to the last segment. In the last segment, I think we ought to talk about where do we go from here. How do we? Is there any? Is there any path towards fixing?
I got some theories.
Okay, well let's talk about that because I think you're the generation and you're the outlook that needs to do it. Okay.
All right. Happy to help.
Sandy Williams sitting in for Earl Ingram, the Earl Ingram Show, Wednesday morning. This is the last segment. I'm talking to Mark Ard, a Marine vet, a good friend, and a smart guy. And we're talking about some international affairs. We've got Stephen from Green Bay who's called in. I think he called in earlier. Stephen, how are you this morning?
Good morning, Sandy. You're doing a fabulous job in the place of Earl this morning, so I just wanted to say that to start.
Well,
and
don't tell Earl.
but I wanted to say a couple things to Mark while you have him on the show. The first thing I want to say to Mark is thank you so much for your service. I think people that, you know, make the choice to fight for this country, obviously they make the ultimate sacrifice. And I make it a mission of mine whenever I see someone who has done that to personally thank them for the bravery and the love they show for this country to go do that. But
thank
I do have
brother.
A question for you as well. What do you think about people who have never been in the military, but they have this ideological mindset that we as Americans can do whatever we want because if we tick off another country, that our military can just go over there and take care of it for us.
I think it's very convenient for them. I have a deep, passionate, I don't know the right word to use, anger towards people like that because I can't help but think of just all of the... I saw a lot of people die, you know, Americans and Iraqis and whoever else when I was over there. And my family, my mother is a 3 Silver Star. My brother Matthew had done like 2 tours, year-long tours to take, you know, time away from his family, from his job and everything to go serve over there. And, you know, there's millions of families out there that have gone through so much and have sacrificed so much. And to listen to anyone who, you know, for whatever their reason is, I don't know, I can't get behind it, I can't put myself in their place, that are advocating for, beating the drums for, whatever you want to say, a war, whether it's to support Ukraine, you know, to put boots on the grounds in Ukraine. I mean, I don't know, man. It really upsets me. I mean, it really does. And sometimes I think, you know, maybe the first people to advocate for war, we should have a law. They should be the first ones drafted. You know what I mean? And just and see how that turns out. Or I would even borrow them my boots and give them a ride to the recruiting station if they needed it. You know, if they're so concerned, you know. I don't know. I can't wrap my head around it. I think it's disgusting. I think it's just, it's insulting. And I mean, what can you say, man?
Well, and I think that one of the problems America has is that warfare has always been something that happens over there. Where, you know, we had the Civil War and we experienced the horror of war once in that fashion. We had the Revolutionary War, both are well back in our rearview mirror. Every other war, well, you know, every other war has in many respects been a foreign adventure. And, you know, our involvement in World War II might well have been pivotal to the Western Front and the winning of that war. But we lost 450,000 warriors in the war.
Yeah.
Russia lost 26 million citizens.
Which is a small number compared to,
Every other European country lost people in the millions, okay? Yeah. They experienced real war. And so I think that those countries have a much greater likelihood of wanting to weigh the real interest of the country, the real interest of, for instance, Germans are being much more circumspect about getting involved.
Much more reflective.
About getting involved in Ukraine.
Not
they
so
know
knee-jerk.
What war does.
Well, I think that's because there's an element of accountability. And in our country, all the people who going back just to the Iraq war, the people who profited, the lobbyists, the journalists, so-called journalists, all of those people who profited, who were on that bandwagon, who pushed for it, and none of them, my guess is, my assumption is that they, and I can think of some off the top of my head I won't mention here, but how do we hold them accountable? And there hasn't been any accountability. I mean, no one has gone to jail that I'm aware of. I mean, considering that this, it's so immense for any one person. It just makes my blood boil and makes me want to take a hard turn into journalism and just, go to their house and sit there with a bullhorn and not let them get a wink sleep for the rest of their lives, so that they can feel and understand the pain and the suffering and the catastrophe that they were complicit in. And I don't know how we hold those people to account other than, public shaming and I don't know.
Well, I think this fact is that for Washington, foreign affairs has become something much more like an impersonal video game.
Of course. They're completely untethered and disconnected and from people, regular people and who and actually people, go over there,
And this notion of neocon or neoliberal power politics, flexing our muscle wherever we choose, beating the drums in Taiwan. We can talk about the Chinese
boots
now,
on the ground
now
in
acting,
Ukraine.
Well, we can talk now about the Chinese being more aggressive, but they certainly, everyone must understand that the Chinese apparent aggressiveness is in response.
Yeah.
To
these things don't happen in a vacuum.
Yeah, things that, so I've...
It takes two to tango, what I mean?
I've described this earlier, but we in the world are yin, and we are the biggest yin, and the rest
That's
of the world
right.
are yang.
It's amazing to me that, again, it's looking at your own side through rose-colored glasses and not being objective or nuanced when trying to wrap your head around this. It's, in political science, we call this, that's a tangent too, but it really irritates me. And I think it irritates a lot of people.
Well, we've only got a couple of minutes. I was hoping to get around to the notion of what does someone in your situation see as the cure to this. But is there one thing that you could point at and we can come back to this?
I think the one thing we need to do more than anything is get money out of politics. Break the back of the lobbyists. That entire complex, that whole industry of lobbying our politicians that have completely captured the government, we need to break the back of that. And I think the only way we're going to do that is by forming political parties that terminally bypasses the two-party system that we have that is completely untethered from the corporate dollar, the money, and its influence.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the only way that's going to happen in this country is a grassroots alternate third party or multiple party system that can really make changes here. And it's only going to happen from the grassroots, from the ground up.
Well, we're in the verge of closing here, but Tom from Los Angeles didn't call in this morning, but you just said exactly what Tom from Los Angeles would have said had he called in. And I think that if this show can have any effect, I hope it has an effect of causing people to listen, re-examine how we behave and why we behave the way we do, and to re-examine our domestic politics.
Yes.
Because it's having an effect domestically on our priorities and on the world.